The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 17th, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. The drawing on the front this week has an elephant, a Republican elephant in the foreground. He's got a Trump button. He's got his hands folded, and he's got a real worried look on his face. In the background, you can see you're in some sort of ballroom. There are balloons on the floor, and there's an upside-down Gillespie polling advertisement. And the title says Backlash, an anti-Trump wave leaves Republicans fretting about 2018. And that is our first main story. An anti-Trump wave boosts Democrats. What happened? Democrat Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam won a bitterly fought race for Virginia governor this week, capping off a wave of victories for the Democratic Party as voters delivered a stinging rebuke of President Trump on the first anniversary of his election. Northam defeated his opponent, former Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie, by 9 points, amid the highest turnout for any gubernatorial race in 20 years. While Gillespie refused to campaign directly with Trump, the Republican candidate adopted many of the president's positions on cultural issues, defending Confederate monuments, and linking Northam to the MS-13 Central American gang. Trump had recorded a robocall and tweeted in support of Gillespie, but disavowed him after his defeat, saying that Republican did not embrace me or what I stand for. The Democratic sweep extended both down the ballot and in races across the country. Democrats were on the verge of regaining control of Virginia's House of Delegates, pending a recount, with transgender activist Danica Rome unseating state lawmaker Robert G. Marshall, who described himself as the state's chief homophobe. In New Jersey, Republican Chris Christie's lieutenant governor suffered a landslide gubernatorial defeat to former banker Phil Murphy, while in Maine, a Democratic-supported initiative to expand Medicaid passed by a nearly 20-point margin. Democrats also took control of the Washington State Senate. This is a tidal wave, said polling expert David Wasserman. Democrats are the current favorite for control of the House in 2018. What the editorial said. The Virginia gubernatorial result was a decisive rejection of Trump's white nationalism and hateful politics, said the New York Times. Gillespie started off the campaign as mainstream Republican, but when he lagged in the polls, he chose to dog whistle himself breathless in pursuit of the state's pro-Trump white voters. He ran inflammatory ads featuring menacing tattooed MS-13 gang members, accusing Northam of being weak on illegal immigration. Gillespie even tried to portray his opponent as a defender of child sex abusers. Trump claims the former lobbyist didn't embrace him or what he stands for. Gillespie did, and he lost. Pro-Northam groups did their fair share of dragging this election into the gutter, said the Richmond Times-Dispatch. A liberal Latino group paid for a highly divisive campaign ad depicting a racist Gillespie supporter in a pickup truck chasing minority children. This was a toxic, dispiriting election, said the Virginian pilot, fueled by political tribalism on both sides. Unfortunately, in the Trump era, it's probably indicative of what voters elsewhere can expect in the coming years. What the columnist said. So much for the Democrats being in disarray, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. Team Blue didn't just win big in Virginia. Democratic candidates also picked up unexpected legislative seats and mayoralties in Georgia, North Carolina, and other states. Widespread Trump revulsion is helping Democrats overcome their historic Achilles heel, turning out non-white voters in a non-presidential year. Republicans had better brace themselves, said John Podhertz in CommentaryMagazine.com. Until now, it seemed like Trump possessed mystical powers, enabling Republicans to avoid the electoral consequences of his historically dismal approval ratings, currently at 37%. Now, political gravity has reasserted itself. Trump is mobilizing Democratic voters in huge numbers, increasing the chances that their party will regain control of the House in 2018. Republicans need to adapt, and fast, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Hitching their wagon to Trumpism clearly isn't worth the degradation, and the only way to avoid being dragged down by this relentlessly obnoxious president is to distance themselves from him. Trump himself should be very worried, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Polls find Republicans down 10 points in a generic House contest. And while the president often treats congressional Republicans with disdain, their fates are intertwined. In 2019, even a thin Democratic majority would open the floodgates of oversight that Republicans have kept shut, with hearings extending well beyond the Russia matter to the Trump family's systematic conflicts of interest. If this wave keeps building, the president could find himself in big trouble. And before we move from this page, I'd like to read you an It Wasn't All Bad item. An American woman hadn't won the New York City Marathon in 40 years until Shalana Flanagan crossed the finish line in first place this week. The 36-year-old Massachusetts native beat defending champion Mary Keatney of Kenya by just 1 minute and 1 second, clocking in at 2 hours, 26 minutes, and 53 seconds. Flanagan finished with tears in her eyes, shouting and cheering. She said she dreamed of winning the race since she was a little girl. "It took me years to do this," said Flanagan, draped in the American flag. "Hopefully it inspires the next generation of women to just be patient." Our controversy of the week is titled, "The Democrats, Brazil Reopens the 2016 Wound." That sound you hear is the primal scream of millions of Bernie bros, said David French in NationalReview.com. They were right. The system was rigged. Last week, Donna Brazile, former chair of the Democratic National Committee, went public with explosive claims that the DNC effectively gave control of the party to Hillary Clinton's campaign months before the primaries even began. In an article in Politico.com, excerpted from an upcoming book, Brazile says that her predecessor at the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, cut a fundraising deal with the Clinton campaign that helped the DNC pay off $25 million in debt in return for giving Clinton control over hiring and strategy. Since the debacle of 2016, the unifying horror of President Trump has enabled the Democratic Party to paper over its internal divisions, said Aaron Blake in WashingtonPost.com. But the rift between pro-Sanders insurgent left and the pro-Clinton party establishment was never resolved. What Brazil has just done is the equivalent of taking the smoldering embers of the 2016 primary and throwing some gasoline on them. "Sorry," said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com, "but some of Brazil's allegations just don't add up. The fundraising agreement between Clinton and the DNC was known to Sanders and well publicized last year. It mostly applied to the general election, not the primaries. Besides, it's hardly unusual for the party's national committee to have a preference for an established, loyal Democrat of Clinton's stature over an outsider like Sanders, who was a registered independent for decades. States, not the DNC, determine the timing of primaries and run them, and voters ultimately chose the nominee, giving Clinton 3.7 million more votes than Sanders. Brazil's motives here are patently obvious, said Beckett Adams in WashingtonExaminer.com. She bet on the wrong horse in 2016, even feeding primary debate questions to Clinton when she worked for CNN. Now, with far-left heroes like Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in ascendance, she's trying to rewrite history to ensure she survives the coming house cleaning. Refighting the 2016 election may feel like an exercise in after-the-fact finger-pointing, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com, but the party remains in serious danger of another electoral catastrophe unless it resolves why it lost. Democrats need to figure out how to talk to the Trump base in the formerly Democratic states of Middle America. Can white, working-class voters be wooed back if the party moves left and promises free health care and education and higher taxes on the rich? Or should the party hold the center and bet on Trump so badly damaging the Republican brand that there's a major backlash? Democrats need to choose a path now, said Joyanne Reed in thedailybeast.com. Otherwise, they'll enter next year's midterms with no discernible message, no recognizable plan, and no real response to Trump's serial rending of basic decency and honor. Democrats have already decided on moving left, said Jonah Goldberg in nationalreview.com, and Brazil knows it. The Clintonistas are done. All the passion in the party is for Sanders' warmed-over hippie socialism and the angry, sanctimony-besotted identity politics popular on college campuses. Neither approach has much appeal to working-class voters in Middle America, so the Democrats' best argument is, we're not Republicans. Under Trump, Republicans are even more dysfunctional. Neither party has a coherent message or inspiring leadership. In this era of crumbling institutions, it's possible both parties are doomed, and no one can say they didn't have it coming. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for self-reinvention. After Sean Combs announced he's added Brother Love to his list of alter egos, which include Diddy, P. Diddy, Puffy, and Puff Daddy. I am just not who I am before, explained the hip-hop impresario, age 48. I'm something different. It was a good week for an abundance of caution after an 81-year-old German man reported finding an unexploded World War II bomb in his garden. Police determined the object to be an extremely large zucchini, while noting that the vegetable really did look very like a bomb. And it was a good week for catching a breath when a rogue Twitter employee deactivated President Trump's account for 11 minutes. The culprit, Twitter later clarified, was a customer service employee who did this on the employee's last day. But it was a bad week for RUI after a Florida woman was arrested for drunkenly riding a horse along a busy street at 1:30 p.m. Donna Byrne, age 53, put herself and the horse in danger, said Sheriff Grady Judd. It was a bad week for Southern Californians, who have the most stress-inducing commutes in the nation, according to a new study. The average Southern Cal resident faces a drive of 53.7 minutes to work and spends 104 hours stuck in traffic every year. And finally, it was a bad week for a jury of one's peers when a jury in the corruption trial of Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, sent a note to the judge asking, "What is a senator?" The judge declined to answer, instructing jurors to rely on their individual and collective memories. And before we move on, we'll take a boring but important item that's listed here. Obamacare enrollments surge compared with 2016. The number of people who signed up for Obamacare health insurance plan surged last week compared with the same period last year, despite the Trump administration's steep cuts in marketing for the enrollment period. More than 200,000 Americans enrolled in a health insurance plan under the Affordable Care Act on November 1st, the first day of open enrollment. Twice as many as signed up on the first day of coverage in 2016. More than 1 million people visited healthcare.gov, a 33% increase in traffic from 2016. However, fewer people may sign up overall this year, given that the Trump administration has cut the open enrollment period from 12 weeks to 6 weeks. On the briefing page, we have the history of tax reform. Republicans want to overhaul the tax code. How did previous reforms lead to the system we have today? How has the tax code evolved? Our modern tax system has its roots in the Civil War. To help fund the Union war effort, President Abraham Lincoln signed the first federal income tax into law in 1861, a temporary flat tax of 3% on annual incomes above $800. The next year, Congress created what would become the Internal Revenue Service. The wartime income taxes were never meant to be permanent and lapsed in 1872. When Congress passed another income tax in 1894, it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in a 5-4 vote. A progressive income tax became a cause celebre among progressive-era reformers fighting the gaping inequality of the Gilded Age, leading to the passage in 1913 of a constitutional amendment, the 16th, legalizing federal taxation. Congress imposed the first permanent income tax the same year, with a top rate of 7% on annual incomes above $500,000, which would be about $12.5 million today. Where did rates go from there? Mostly up. The U.S. passed massive tax hikes to pay for World War I, including the first version of the estate tax, and raise taxes yet again to finance the enormous cost of World War II. In 1944, the top income bracket peaked at 94% on taxable income over $200,000, which would be about $2.5 million today. When did taxes start to come down? Arguing that the World War II tax regime exerted too heavy a drag on growth in peacetime, President John F. Kennedy in 1963 called for slashing the top rate for individuals from 91% to a more reasonable 65%. Kennedy's plan met stiff resistance from conservative Democrats and Republicans, who worried about the plan's impact on the deficit. It fell to President Lyndon Johnson to shepherd a bill through Congress with an emotional appeal to lawmakers after Kennedy's assassination. The Revenue Act of 1964 lowered the top individual tax rate to 70% and the bottom rate to 14% from 20%, while reducing the corporate tax rate from 52% to 48%. It would be 17 years before the next across-the-board tax cuts passed under President Ronald Reagan. What did Reagan do? In his first term, he signed what by some measures remains the biggest tax cut in American history, slashing the top individual rate from 70% to 50%. Reagan sought even more dramatic changes in his second term, calling for a total revamping of the U.S. tax code. He and his advisors worked with Congress for 2 years to hammer out the details. The resulting 1986 Tax Reform Act dramatically simplified the U.S. tax code, shrinking the number of tax brackets from 15 to just 2, 15 and 28%. The bill was also revenue neutral, paid for in part by eliminating $60 billion in tax loopholes and shifting $24 billion in taxes from individuals to businesses. Why was Reagan successful? Bipartisanship. Reagan actively courted Democrats who controlled the House of Representatives by emphasizing shared goals, such as fewer loopholes for the wealthy and increasing the standard deduction to benefit low-income families. Reagan also agreed to increase the capital gains tax rate from 20% to 28%, a key compromise. The president's 60% public approval rating undoubtedly helped as well. Nevertheless, the bill faced fierce pushback from industry lobbyists seeking to protect their favorite tax breaks. The legislation heavily targeted real estate tax shelters, for example, which enraged New York developer Donald Trump, who told Congress in 1991 that Reagan's tax reforms had been an absolute catastrophe for the country. What has happened since then? President George W. Bush pushed through a major tax cut in 2001, but Reagan's tax bill remains the last true overhaul of the tax code. Since then, the Democratic presidents have raised the top tax rate to 39.6%, while under both Republican and Democratic administrations, the number of tax brackets has expanded to 7, and a cornucopia of new tax breaks and loopholes has been added. The partisan debate over whether cutting taxes fuels growth rages on, though most economists say the economy is affected by so many factors that the impact of lowering rates is murky at best. The economy boomed after Reagan's first round of tax cuts in 1981, but was also helped by a big drop in inflation and interest rates and increased military spending. The 1986 tax bill was followed by a recession in 1990. Taxes went up under the Clinton administration, but the economy grew even faster than it did under Reagan, buoyed by the internet boom. A Congressional Research Service paper in 2012 found no correlation between top tax rates and economic growth. Bruce Bartlett, a former advisor to President Reagan who worked on the 1986 tax bill, argues that true reform should be designed to make the system simpler and fairer, not to put more money in wealthy people's pockets. In reality, he says, there's no evidence that a tax cut now would spur growth. The Kansas experiment. Kansas Republicans embarked on what Governor Sam Brownback called a real live experiment in 2012. The plan eliminated state income taxes altogether for so-called pass-through entities, companies filing their taxes as individuals. Brownback and others argued that the tax cuts would pay for themselves by generating massive economic growth, ultimately allowing the state to abolish the income tax altogether. But that growth never materialized, and Kansas now faces an $889 million budget shortfall over the next 2 years. The state has been forced to make deep, unpopular cuts to public education, social services, and even highway repairs, while its credit rating has been downgraded. A coalition of Republicans and Democrats reversed most of the tax cuts this year, overriding Brownback's veto. With many of the same economists who advised Brownback working with the national GOP on its tax plan, some Kansas Republicans are warning Congress not to assume tax cuts will pay for themselves. That won't work, so you better learn our lesson, said State Senator Barbara Boiler. We're into the best columns now. The first from the U.S. This comes from Mark Joseph Stern at Slate.com, titled A Victim's Tax on Gunmakers. Imagine you're in a church, movie theater, concert, or school, and a mass shooter opens fire with an assault-style weapon designed to kill dozens of people in seconds. You wake up in a hospital with grievous wounds, having lost the ability to walk or care for yourself. You should be able to sue the manufacturer and gun dealers and use the money to pay your mammoth medical bills, says Mark Joseph Stern. But under a federal law passed in 2005, gun dealers and manufacturers cannot be sued by people hurt by their products. Indeed, firearms are the only consumer products, including vaccines, drugs, and automobiles, exempted from all liability. Why? Every day, an average of 315 people are shot in this country, and 222 survive, often with serious injuries that drive them into bankruptcy. A Congress cowed by the gun lobby will clearly not change the liability law. But states can help survivors by imposing a new tax on gun sales and firearms revenue and creating a fund for victims. The firearms industry has made billions by creating and flooding the market with ever more destructive weapons, fueling a terrible crisis of gun violence. It should be required to pay for it. This is from Saudi Arabia. A crown prince consolidates power. These are times of major change for Saudi Arabia, says The National in an editorial. In a sweeping anti-corruption purge last week, the kingdom detained 11 princes, four government ministers, and dozens of former officials and businessmen. This royal house cleaning is taking place against a backdrop of sweeping social and political changes within the kingdom. Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the 32-year-old likely successor to his father, King Salman, has spearheaded a modernization drive in recent months, developing ambitious economic plans for the kingdom's post-oil future, lifting the country's ban on women drivers, and promising a crackdown on Islamist extremists. But reforms can only work in a transparent landscape, one that can't be realized if money-hoarding royals keep milking the kingdom of billions of dollars through rigged business deals. In the new Saudi Arabia, no one is above the law. U.S. President Trump is cheering on this corruption crackdown, said Arab News. King Salman and the Crown Prince, Trump tweeted this week, know exactly what they're doing. This purge isn't about corruption, said David Gardner in the Financial Times. It's about consolidating power. The arrest came just hours after the establishment of an anti-corruption commission headed by the Crown Prince, who earlier this year pushed aside an older cousin to become the first in line to the throne. Among those detained was Prince Miteb bin Abdullah, the 65-year-old former head of the powerful National Guard. The Guard, built around the kingdom's intricate tribal networks, is probably the last autonomous power center standing between the Crown Prince and the throne. More puzzling is the arrest of billionaire Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, said Jamal El-Shalah in Qatar-based Al Jazeera.com. On paper, Mohammed and the 62-year-old tycoon, who has investments in Apple, Citigroup, and other Western blue-chip firms, sound like a match made in heaven. Both want to transform Saudi Arabia into a secular society, and both detest democracy. Al-Walid's sin may have been his refusal to put up money to support the Saudi economy, which has sputtered since oil prices dropped precipitously in 2014. The message from Prince Mohammed to the elite is, pay up or get locked up. Mohammed is attempting to pull off a difficult balancing act, said Michael Stevens in the Daily Telegraph. With oil revenue shrinking, Saudi Arabia has to cut its generous welfare state and bloated public sector. But the crown prince knows he can't ask the public, two-thirds of whom are under 30, to go through austerity while tolerating widespread elite corruption. Hence the purges. A few fat cats thrown to the fire should mean a few more months of breathing space. The crown prince still has worries. Conservative clerics are angry at the direction he's taking the country, as are disgruntled royals. In the long term, his reform agenda might provide stability for Saudi Arabia. Short term, however, it could be a bumpy ride. And from China, an editorial from the Global Times is titled, "The West is Descending into Chaos." What on earth is happening to the West? Asked the Global Times. Not so long ago, the U.S. and Europe were stable, prosperous places, happy to lecture others about the superiority of their democratic systems. Today, they have much less to boast about. Their angry electorates have voted in populists who care little for traditional values and political order. Terrorist attacks have become almost routine in their cities. And now separatists in Catalonia and elsewhere threaten to break apart their nation-states. This series of events may not be a temporary phenomenon, but instead reflect a deeper problem. The old order has been shaken by the rapid evolution of technologies, including social media and the increased automation of work. And Western democracy has utterly failed to adapt to this new world. Political parties have moved to the ideological extremes, which has eroded their ability to compromise and pass legislation. And rather than trying to build unity, Western elites instead simply blame one another for society's disintegration. The slogan of change has frequently appeared in Western election campaigns, but the so-called changes are all formality. Until its leaders rediscover their political authority and moral compass, the decline of the West will continue. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, "The Boomtown Built on Lies." Cape Coral, Florida was built on a swamp by hucksters and could be wiped off the map by a powerful storm, said journalist Michael Grunwald. It also just happens to be the fastest growing city in the U.S. The ads promised paradise. Legendary lazy living in a waterfront wonderland. The brochure sold the Florida dream, an enchanted city in the making, average temperature 71.2 degrees, without winter, worries, or state income taxes. Cape Coral was America's land of tomorrow, just $20 down and $20 a month for a quarter-acre slice of heaven. Breathtaking, isn't it? How could it be otherwise when nature was so lavishly generous to begin with? The Rasso family moved from Pittsburgh to Cape Coral on September 14, 1960, lured by that sunny vision of affordable utopia. At the time, the vision was just about all there was. The city in the making was still mostly uninhabitable swampland, with just a few dozen homes along a few mosquito-swarmed dirt roads. We were pioneers in a station wagon instead of a covered wagon, recalls Gloria Rasso Tate, who was 9 years old when she piled into the back seat with her three sisters and a mutt named Peppy. The Rassos quickly discovered that in some ways, nature had not been so lavishly generated to Cape Coral. They arrived in town the same hour as Hurricane Donna, which was shredding southwest Florida with winds of 120 miles per hour. They spent their first night in paradise in a house with no roof. My mom was not a happy camper. She thought the storm was a sign we never should have come to Florida, Rasso Tate says. But my dad was Mr. Positive. He believed in the dream. Rasso Tate's true-believing dad soon became a top salesman for Cape Coral's developer, Gulf American, peddling paradise on layaway, promoting one of the most notorious land scams in Florida's scammy history. Gulf American unloaded tens of thousands of low-lying Cape Coral lots on dream seekers all over the world before the authorities cracked down on its frauds and deceptions. It passed off inaccessible mush as prime real estate and sold the same swampy lots to multiple buyers. Its hucksters spun a soggy floodplain between the Calasuhatchee River and the Gulf of Mexico as America's middle-class boomtown of the future. And suckers bought it. The thing is, the hucksters were right, and so were the suckers. Cape Coral is now the largest city in America's fastest-growing metropolitan area. Its population has soared from fewer than 200 when the Rassos arrived to 180,000 today. Its low-lying swamps have been drained thanks to an astonishing 400 miles of canals, the most of any city on Earth, that serve not only as the city's stormwater management system, but also its defining real estate amenity. Those ditches were an ecological disaster, ravaging wetlands, estuaries, and aquifers. Cape Coral was a planning disaster, too, designed without water or sewer pipes, shops or offices, or almost anything but pre-platted residential lots. But people flocked there. Anyway, the title of a memoir by a Gulf American secretary captured the essence of Cape Coral. Lies that came true. As Florida cleans up after Hurricane Irma, which almost precisely followed Donna's path through the Keys to Florida's southwest coast, some Americans are asking what the hell 20 million people are doing in a flood-prone, storm-battered peninsula that was once the nation's last unpopulated frontier. Federal taxpayers will spend billions of dollars on Irma relief, even though Irma did not turn out to be the big one. A slightly different track could have drowned cities like Miami or Tampa, boosting that price tag to hundreds of billions. Americans are also paying for a $16 billion project to resuscitate the dying Everglades, just part of the cost they will bear for the build-out of the Florida dream. Cape Coral may be the best place to gauge the future of the dream and to see whether Florida has any hope of overcoming its zany developmental, political, and environmental history, because Cape Coral is the ultimate microcosm of Florida. It's literally a peninsula jutting off the peninsula, the least natural, worst planned, craziest growing piece of an unnatural, badly planned, crazy growing state. Man has sculpted it into an almost comically artificial landscape, with seven island section featuring seven perfectly rectangular islands and an eight lakes neighborhood featuring eight perfectly square lakes. And while much of Florida now yo-yos between routine droughts and routine floods, Cape Coral's fluctuations are particularly wild. This spring, the city faced a water shortage so dire that its fire department feared it couldn't rely on its hydrants. Yet this summer, the city endured a record-breaking flood. Much of Cape Coral faced a mandatory evacuation during Irma because the forecast called for as much as 15 feet of storm surge blasting into its canals, and much of the city is just a few feet above sea level. The Red Cross opened only two shelters in town because it doesn't open shelters in vulnerable flood zones. As the storm approached, Rasso Tate was texting with those three sisters who joined her in that backseat 57 years ago, and a fourth sister born a few months later, who is, of course, named Donna. We were like, oh no, it's happening again. This could be the end of Cape Coral, Gloria said. But Irma swerved slightly, so while it hit Cape Coral hard enough to knock out power lines and damage seawalls, it didn't drown the city. We got lucky, she says. So life goes on. Let me stop for a brief editorial note. I just realized that I've been reading the name wrong. It's not Cape Coral, it's Cape Coral. So we'll go on with the proper pronunciation. Cape Coral's planners expected its population to double again over the next two decades. Like it or not, Florida is going to keep growing too because baby boomers are retiring and the sun is still shining. Since World War II, the state's population has skyrocketed from 27th to 3rd in the nation. The real question is how it will prepare for its increasingly crowded future and deal with the mistakes of its land-by-the-gallon pass. Even when communities like Cape Coral try to adjust to modern realities, it's not easy to escape their original sins. Leonard Rosen, the marketing dynamo from Baltimore who invented Cape Coral, was a visionary and a rogue. He and his brother Jack got rich selling an anti-baldness tonic made from lanolin, a wool grease secreted by sheep. They promoted it with some of America's first infomercials, featuring the immortal tagline, "Have you ever seen a bald sheep?" Leonard's daughter, Linda Sterling, remembers him as a self-educated genius and warm-hearted philanthropist, but also a relentless snake oil salesman and incorrigible rule breaker. He drove the wrong way on one-way streets. He wore tennis clothes to meetings with his Wall Street bankers. The Rosen brothers realized they could sell Florida as another miracle elixir, a rich man's paradise within the financial reach of everyone. They started with some rugged mangrove swamp and palmetto scrub known as Redfish Point, which they rebranded as Cape Coral. Their dredges and draglines dug drainage ditches through the muck, then dumped the fill along the banks of the new canals, moving enough dirt to fill a swimming pool every minute. Then they built homes on top of the fill to create a maze of waterfront properties where neither waterfront nor property had ever existed. The instant alchemy of Florida real estate. Sure, the water the properties fronted was basically plumbing for a suburbanized floodplain, but it still sparkled in the sun. The Rosen's real innovation was selling Cape Coral as frenetically as they sold their magic hair products. They gave away homes on game shows like The Price is Right. They brought in celebrities like Bob Hope and Anita Bryant to promote the dream. They had telemarketers hawking lots with Glengarry Glen Ross-style blarney. They sent sales reps across the ocean. Gloria Rasso Tate's dad pitched paradise in London and Rome, and planted touts at Florida hotels and attractions, luring tourists to free steak dinners, interrupted by salesmen shouting, "Lot number 18 is sold," and paid ringers yelling, "I just bought one." Prospective buyers were offered free stays at the company motel, where rooms were bugged to help salesmen customize their pitches, and taken on company Cessnas for flying bys to see lots the pilots reserved by dropping sacks of flour from the sky. Cape Coral was brilliantly orchestrated and terribly planned, says Florida historian Gary Mormino, author of Land of Sunshine, State of Dreams. They built an instant city on steroids with none of the stuff you need to make a city work. The Rosens did build Cape Coral, a yacht club, and a snazzy pavilion featuring the country's largest rose garden and a dancing fountain called Waltzing Waters. But those amenities were sales tools, intended to produce the illusion of a community for potential residents. There were no schools or churches or almost anything else in Cape Coral in its early days. Just houses scattered randomly all over town. You had to read between the lines of the ads to grasp this inconvenient truth. Supermarkets, department stores, theaters, plenty to do in the nearby thriving city of Fort Myers. This house's only problem is no longer so extreme, but it's still a big problem. The vast majority of Cape Coral's 120 square miles was sold off piecemeal for single-family residential lots. So it took city planners more than a decade to assemble the adjoining parcels it needed to attract Target, a task requiring negotiations with property owners as far away as Switzerland and Hong Kong. It took nearly as long to bring in a Home Depot. The Rosens also neglected to build Cape Coral any water or sewer infrastructure, and it has no direct access to the interstate, or even a good swimming beach. So it has struggled to attract businesses. Unlike smaller but better-known neighborhoods like Fort Myers and Naples, Cape Coral has no colleges, no arenas, no significant corporate offices, no real tourist destinations, only one luxury hotel, a downtown with no focal point, and hardly any commercial tax base. The Rosens also left a brutal environmental legacy that still haunts Cape Coral. They tore down most of the coastal mangroves that had provided natural storm protection to this exposed spit of land, as well as vital spawning and feeding grounds for its fisheries. They drained and paved wetlands that once absorbed the area's floodwaters and recharged its aquifers. Local wells ran dry from the start, and the city now mines its drinking water from a finite supply 800 feet underground. Cape Coral is what happens when you obliterate your natural resources, said Cynthia Barnett, author of a book about Florida's water called Mirage. It's supposed to be the water wonderland, and they've got one water crisis after another. When you borrow that heavily from the environment, the bill comes due. Still, it's not a coincidence that the Cape Coral Fort Myers area has recorded America's most explosive population growth 2 years in a row, and a remarkable 5 years out of the past 13. For a lot of transplants, it feels like a subtropical version of their northern suburbs and villages. A city with small-town vibe, plus sunshine and backyard boat docks. Brian Tattersall, an insurance broker from Barrie, Ontario, took me for a ride on his 29-foot Sea Fox through Cape Coral's canals one balmy afternoon. The Gulf breeze was lovely, even though we could see giant piles of Irma debris along the shore. There are several dozen Barrie natives living in Cape Coral because word about the afternoons like this travels. People say, "Are you crazy living in Florida with all those hurricanes?" Tattersall told me as we drifted through a slow-speed manatee zone. "Come on, does this feel crazy?" He recalled a recent outing with his grandchildren where they saw dolphins and stingrays. "That's what life is about, right?" I asked him whether he thought Irma would scare away the next generation of newcomers, and he scoffed. "No way," he said. Then he reconsidered. "Look, if we get 15 feet of storm surge, holy blank, that would take out Cape Coral." Another pause. He sipped his Bud Light. Even then, no way. This was excerpted from an article that was originally published in Politico magazine. We'll read one of the health and science articles. It's called Preventing Suicides with AI. Most people who think about killing themselves never reveal their plans to anyone, making suicidal behavior extremely difficult to predict or prevent. But a new study suggests artificial intelligence could address this problem through brain scans that effectively predict who is most likely to attempt suicide. Researchers have developed a machine learning algorithm that uses brain scans to identify those with suicidal thoughts. They tested the technology on 34 young adults, including 17 who had a history of suicidal thoughts or behavior. The participants were shown 30 words as their brains were scanned. Some were related to suicide, such as death. Others were feelings such as desperate and carefree. By analyzing brain patterns, the algorithm was able to distinguish between the people who had considered suicide and those who had not with 91% accuracy, NPR.org reports. Lead author Marcel Just, a cognitive neuroscientist at Carnegie Mellon University, says there really is a difference in the way suicidal people think about certain concepts. And we'll move right on over to the talking points page with the Republican tax plan. Who wins and who loses? America's sluggish economy may soon get the boost it has so badly needed, said Judd Gregg in TheHill.com. This week, House Republicans began marking up their long-awaited rewrite of the tax code, a 429-page overhaul plan designed to kickstart the economy following years of lackluster growth. Under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the corporate tax rate will be slashed from 35% to 20%, thus leveling the playing field of international competition, incentivizing companies to keep their profits here, and luring foreign companies to U.S. soil. That will be a job-creating juggernaut. Small and medium-sized businesses, partnerships, and S-corporations will enjoy a new 25% pass-through rate that will enable them to expand, hire more workers, and raise wages. To pay for these cuts, Republicans plan to severely limit or eliminate a number of itemized tax breaks for individuals. But the standard deduction will almost double to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for families, making it unnecessary for most middle-income taxpayers to itemize, while the entire federal income tax system will be simplified into four brackets, 12%, 25%, 35%, and 39.6%. The gains from corporate tax reform will start small but will grow year after year, said Martin Feldstein in the Wall Street Journal. Within a decade, annual national income could rise by $500 billion, equal to $3,500 a household. That will outweigh adding $1.5 trillion to the national debt. Sorry, but the math doesn't work, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% and phasing out the estate tax on inheritances creates such a massive shortfall in revenues, $5.5 trillion over 10 years, that Republicans have proposed clawing back $3.8 trillion, mostly by eliminating deductions for millions of individual taxpayers. In fact, nearly one-third of middle-class families earning between $50,000 and $160,000 would face a higher tax bill as soon as 2018, according to a New York Times analysis. In general, the Republican bill reads as if it was reverse engineering from 30-second political attack ads, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. To pay for their corporate tax cut, Republicans plan to eliminate several worthy and popular tax breaks for large and sympathetic groups, including deductions for state and local taxes and the mortgage interest deduction benefiting millions of American homeowners, millions of them in blue states. The GOP also eliminates tax credits for hiring veterans and to defray the cost of adoption, as well as deductions for student loan interest and extraordinary medical cost. That's political poison. Not surprisingly, Republicans are trying to rush this bill through in a matter of weeks before public opinion derails it, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. This reform is a naked giveaway to corporations and the 1%. The rich will benefit from the elimination of the alternative minimum tax, the only reason President Trump paid any substantial federal taxes in 2005, and from the gradual elimination of the estate tax, currently paid by only 0.2% of households on estates worth more than $5.49 million. There are also vast new opportunities for tax avoidance for wealthy Americans who will pass themselves off as dummy corporations to qualify for the new 25% pass-through rate. Democrats are freaking out for good reason, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. They know corporate tax reform will juice the economy, ensuring continued Republican control of Congress and Trump's reelection. In 2012, President Obama proposed lowering the corporate tax rate to 28%, not as a thank you to corporate America, but to get businesses expanding and hiring. That's what this tax cut will do. Politically, Democrats simply cannot afford that sort of prosperity. Republicans, on the other hand, cannot afford seeing their tax bill crash and burn, which is a real possibility, said A.B. Stoddard in RealClearPolitics.com. Warring House and Senate factions, including blue state Republicans, social conservatives, and fiscal conservatives, are already demanding changes to the bill. Republican leaders will have to reconcile a host of different demands while walking a shaky tightrope, with just a two-seat Senate majority and rules that allow them to add only $1.5 trillion to the deficit. But after efforts to repeal Obamacare collapsed in chaos, the GOP knows another major failure would enrage its voters and pose an existential threat to the party's control of Congress. It's not sunny optimism that has Republicans insisting they will pass tax reform by Christmas. It's fear of the apocalypse. And that leaves us just enough time to finish with a quote today. This is from Zora Neale Hurston, quoted in the New York Times. She says, "No, I do not weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.